Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Wow, what a show yesterday. We had quite a discussion. Kyle is with us from Sacramento, California for, I think, the whole show. He called in shortly after we started. And it was fascinating. Wednesdays are a good day for that if you want to join me for the show. And this is unusual as talk shows go because, you know, usually you get to say about 30 seconds worth of stuff and the host says, hey, thanks for calling. Let's move on now. You know, and that's fine for them, but that's not fine for me. Because I want to know what you know. I want to know, you know, over time, you know, and if the format allows, well, not the format, that's a stupid word, but if the show, the way it's structured for that particular day allows it, then, you know, you can stick around for a while. And a lot of times I'll build callers through the course of the show, and we may start with one or two and have, you know, four or five or more sometimes by the end of the show, and that's perfectly fine. When it gets too many, of course, we can't do that, but that's a good way to get going. It was amazing to go through the timeline that I've been putting together for me because I realized the detail. And of course, you know, when you read something out loud, it allows you to make connections that you wouldn't make necessarily otherwise. And so that in itself is fascinating. Of course, the problem is, you know, everything leads to something else. So now I've got two other articles, one of which I'm going to go over here in a couple of minutes, that have given me a whole bunch of new items for my timeline. And so this timeline keeps growing. Pretty soon you're going to see the day-to-day changes. We're going to be able to track the whole thing based on many different articles and things that I've put together. But there's a lot that's going on that that people don't seem to know about because you never see the totality of what happened and put it all together. And you realize what I realize is the treachery of Dr. Fascist and his just blatant disregard for human life and absolute greed and obsession with money. And so what we really need to do is, you know, if anybody's tax record should be examined, it should be Dr. Anthony Fauci, who we actually call around here Dr. Fascist, okay? So that would be the first thing I would do is get a hold of his taxes because you're going to find – and how many patents does he own or control or have an interest in or partially own or get royalties from or any of those things? Because that is another, I think, fascinating area that would be interesting to analyze and see, you know, how much you know, how much is he making beyond his $500,000 salary? Well, 400 and some odd thousand, you know, but he's the highest, he's paid higher than the president, you know, which is fascinating. Anyway, a lot is happening. A lot is going on right now. I was listening this morning, besides my usual One American News briefing, to the House, I guess it's called the House Select Committee. And it was a hearing on coronavirus and the origins of it. And they're still focusing on the Wuhan lab. And I still find this fascinating because I've been saying for months that, yeah, well, we knew about that last year, though it wasn't completely confirmed. Now it's pretty much confirmed. And B, that's not really the issue as far as, you know, we're concerned. Because what do you think you're going to do? Get money from the Chinese Communist Party? Do you think they care? No. They're celebrating their 100th anniversary. They're not going anywhere. They're certainly not going to give us money as much as it might be nice to do. But the really intriguing part for me is to look into the origins in this country. In this country, I believe it's the vaccines. And it goes back to 2010 when, and we talked about this yesterday, 2010 with the formation of Moderna. In fact, I've got an article here on Malone, I think it is, Dr. Malone, who's the inventor of messenger RNA vaccines. So, of course, I'm going to try and get him on the show, but what I really want to do is just read everything that he wrote and go into some of the details of things that he's talked about. And so let's get it from the person himself, you know, the limitations, the possibilities. He's not too thrilled with what's going on, even though he invented it, simply because, you know, it's not being tested. It's not being done. You know, what's happening is they're getting emergency use authorizations to roll out these vaccines as quickly as possible because there's money in it. I mean, this is all about following the money and pushing vaccines as much as possible. And the story is getting more fascinating by the day as to what happened with hydroxychloroquine. And the reason I find that so fascinating is because, you know, my conversations with Dr. Zelenko, who came up with the protocol here, I haven't talked to him, but read, you know, information on Dr. Didier Raoult in France, who came up with the program there. And this is way back at the beginning of the pandemic. So we're talking, you know, February, March, you know, of 2020. And so you realize the extent to which people knew that hydroxychloroquine works, and they purposely demonized it. And let me see. I don't know if I explained this as clearly yesterday as I should have or could have, but the way that these emergency use authorizations work, and this is all new information to me starting from last year. I didn't know anything about any of these people, things, health bureaucracies, any of this kind of stuff. But it's amazing what you learn when you start writing legislation about something, because you have to, because you have to be accurate, right? So what I learned is that in an emergency, in a pandemic, you get a declaration of emergency. Okay. Well, when you get a declaration of emergency, you can do all kinds of emergency things. Now, can you suspend the Constitution? No. Can you limit the constitutional rights of people? No. Did they do it anyway? Yes. Okay. And that's a huge problem. But we'll address that, at another time. But what happens is that certain things can be waived because it's an emergency. You know, it's like, well, we have to act now. It's an emergency. We can't wait 10 years for a vaccine. Well, maybe you should. And the reason, and one of the safeguards against the misuse of emergency use authorizations under a declaration of emergency is that there isn't already a viable proven treatment in existence right now. And so you can't use an emergency new treatment if there's a perfectly valid old treatment that works just fine, okay? So the old treatment that works just fine that everybody knew going back to the mid-80s was hydroxychloroquine, okay? And later ivermectin and other things like vitamin C, vitamin D, and things like that. But everybody knew for decades that the hydroxychloroquine is a great antiviral drug. It's also been used for over 60 years, I think, as an anti-malarial drug. And as the FDA has stated, it's safer than Tylenol. So how do you go about banning a drug that's safer than Tylenol? The only way you can do it is to demonize it and make people and have a whole bunch of news people say, well, if you take this drug, it's going to kill you. Well, that's nonsense, because people take it all the time. They take it as an autoimmune disease. I believe the term is Plaquenil. They take it as hydroxychloroquine. You can take it as a preventive. Chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine is taken all over Africa as a malaria preventive. All right. So it's perfectly safe as a preventive drug. All right. So to all of a sudden have a perfectly safe drug demonized, you have to wonder, why would they do that? Well, the reason is so they could bring about experimental vaccines. Okay. So this is how it works. So this is why I know this was planned years in advance. They knew this too. All right. They knew hydroxychloroquine would cure their COVID-19. They knew that they could take hydroxychloroquine and save their sorry asses if something went wrong. Right. They knew, they're talking about the health bureaucrats, Dr. Fascist and all those folks. They knew that they had to demonize hydroxychloroquine before banning it, or the public wouldn't accept it. They knew that once banned, that drug treatment comes off the table under the declaration of emergency, and they can now authorize vaccines. Okay. So they could not authorize the vaccines that millions of you are now taking until they first demonized, removed, and banned a treatment that's perfectly safe. Think about that. So that takes planning. Okay. That takes organization. That takes knowing exactly what's going on to be able to do that. This is why I say the vaccines came first by years. They created the vaccine, messenger RNA technology, starting probably about 2010, getting it going by 2015. By 2017, Dr. Zaks of Moderna talks about how good it is. We've hacked the software of life. They know how this works. And of course, that's when Trump takes office in January 20th of 2017, and the pandemic hits. Oh, amazingly, 3 years later. What a coincidence. So one of the articles that I found that's giving me even more information that I'm going to have to incorporate into my timeline is this article by Dr. Stephen Hatfield. Now, Dr. Hatfield was on the show when Ann Vandersteel brought him on. And so I'm going to contact him again and get him back for a much more extended period of time, just him, so we can talk more. But he wrote an open letter to America, June 8th of 2021. And what he says is, and I'm just going to read this right through, because it really, I guess the expression is dovetails. I don't know what that means exactly, but it deals directly with what I've just been talking about, okay, and what I talked about yesterday. So he says, "Dear America, this is the story of possibly the greatest corruption scandal in our country's history. This is the story of how petty bureaucrats and drug companies unjustly discredited an inexpensive FDA-approved drug that would have prevented COVID-19 hospitalizations and deaths for political spite and financial gain. These perpetrators, who now hold more significant positions in government, need to be held accountable for over 500,000 American deaths and the disruption of our economy. Yeah, not to mention all the lockdown deaths, loss of businesses, loss of life savings, you know, and everything else that happened with the lockdowns and the mask mandates and all the, you know, problems that those presented and everything else. But think about that. Let's go to this first statement. Petty bureaucrats and drug companies unjustly discredited an inexpensive FDA-approved drug that would have prevented COVID-19 hospitalizations and deaths. Okay? So think about that. Think about the fact that these people wantonly, maliciously, purposely, you know, demonized and banned a treatment that would have saved 500,000 Americans. Okay? Now, if that isn't a genocide, I don't know what is. All right? Now, did they put them in death camps and kill them? No. They killed them by withholding treatment. They killed them by withholding knowledge. They killed them by propaganda and misinformation. You know, misinformation can kill as easily as malpractice. So is this not the most massive malpractice that's ever been done? All right. Anyway, back to his letter. He says, this is the story of how a few key government officials failed to implement our well-formulated national pandemic plan and their weaponization of a dangerously complicit mainstream media. Okay, I learned some things from this too, and I'll point those out as I go through the letter. He says, I tell you this story because we, the people, deserve answers. Of course, that's my job too, right? Those responsible need to be held accountable for their actions. The COVID-19 pandemic was a proverbial warning shot across our bow. Thus, we must forever prioritize pandemic preparedness as critical to our national security. Yeah, warning shot across the bow. Well, it's more than a warning shot. I think it was a torpedo right to the belly, right to the midsection of our country. 500,000 Americans died for probably nothing. If that doesn't shock you, then nothing will. Back to the article. He says, we deserve better. We deserve the truth. We deserve answers. We deserve justice. I hope my words and timeline will help clarify what has happened to who is involved and what action must be taken to protect our health and freedom. My name is Dr. Stephen Hatfill. I am a specialist physician, recognized virologist, and bioweapons expert, and I worked as an outside advisor to the Executive Office of the President of the United States from February 2020 to the inaugural transition period of 2021. My statements are not speculation because I had a front row seat from the very beginning of the pandemic. My subsequent published papers and articles have been painstakingly referenced and fact-checked. Yeah, you look at the bottom of this article, you know, and I think I've got it. I put it on, you know, Facebook several times. But just look it up. You know, a letter to America from Dr. Stephen Hatfill. That's H-A-T-F-I-L-L. Okay. So think about this guy. He's actually a virologist, which Dr. Fascist is not. Dr. Fauci is not a virologist. All right. So how do you get to be? That's the question itself too. How do you get to be the head of the infectious disease, you know, center at the National Institutes for Health, which are primarily, you know, viruses, you know, plus bacteria and germs. But how do you get to be the head of infectious diseases in the United States for over, what, 50 years without being a virologist? Just asking the questions, okay? All right, let's get to the factual. It says, some will tell you this is just another conspiracy theory, so I ask you to read on and judge for yourselves. Yeah, we're going to talk about that Monday. I'm going to sort of analyze the whole theory of conspiracy theories and see what I can do to clear that up as well. Factual events. Now, this is going to go in my timeline, too, and added to everything else I have. 2005, the United States creates its first ever national pandemic plan, outlining the actions to combat a serious respiratory viral disease pandemic. This is based on the previous Biological Weapons Improved Response Plan. So, of course, I have to look both these up. I'm familiar with the 2007 interim pandemic guidelines, which originated, I guess, from these 2005, for the 2005 National Pandemic Plan. I'll fill in the gaps. So, you know, I'll get to that. All right. 2008, President Obama closes the White House Global Health Security Office. Not sure the significance. Doesn't say, but I'll have to look that up. 2013. After the SARS and MERS attack, I guess MERS is the Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome, SARS being the, I'm not sure what SARS stands for. Anyway, it's respiratory, is the first respiratory syndrome. Chinese virologists, oh, trouble with that word, collect hundreds of samples from bats for study at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, the WIV. We know about them, right? Collaborative research begins on the coronaviruses. There's like, what, 6,000 of them, I guess, from one of my readings, including, are you ready, gain-of-function experiments, research which involves increasing the capacity of a pathogen to cause illness. You know, most medical research looks for cures. These people, gain-of-function actually looks to make viruses more dangerous and more deadly and more contagious. Fascinating research, isn't it? They said, well, we have to make it more dangerous to know what happens if it becomes more dangerous. That's insane. That's not logic. That's like saying, well, we better blow up the enemy in case we have to blow up the enemy. I mean, come on, get real. All right, anyway, we'll get to Dr. Pry with a nuclear, you know, logic or policy in a bit. Anyway, so he says, gain-of-function experiments, you know, in China and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Okay, so the University of North Carolina is in this as well, right? So that was in 2013. Okay, so this is before anybody even knew anything about what was going on. These folks are already collecting bat, you know, bat viruses. All right, 2014, the West Africa Ebola virus outbreak occurs. Dr. Anthony Fauci, as we call him, Dr. Fascist, promotes a single layer of gloves for nursing Ebola patients and other inadequate protective measures. His instructions endanger the lives of healthcare workers, and national guidelines for protection must be urgently updated. Yeah, he has a history of doing that. You look at his history, starting with AIDS, where he promoted AZT, which is a very expensive drug, which didn't work, over a drug that New York doctors had discovered. And again, I'll have to look up the name. It starts with a B, but it was a very good treatment. And they came up with a really good treatment for AIDS early on in the AIDS crisis. But Dr. Fascist, you know, being Dr. Fascist and subservient to Big Pharma, you know, promoted AZT because AZT cost a whole lot more money. Does that sound familiar with remdesivir, you know, and all the other treatments he promotes, as opposed to the very inexpensive and very effective hydroxychloroquine? That's the story of Dr. Fascist. He's got a long track record of doing this. 2014, back to the timeline. United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, and the World Health Organization, the WHO, ban gain-of-function research. Isn't that fascinating? The ban was implemented for 2014 to 2017. Oh, yeah, comes off when Trump takes office. Fascinating. Good. See, they want him to take the blame in case anything goes wrong. That's what I think happened. Now, I don't think they knew Trump was going to take office, but I think the ban on gain-of-function ended either legally or illegally when Dr. Fascist took all that stuff to China anyway, because they wouldn't care if it happened in the Trump administration because they can just blame him, right? All right. 2015, here we go. Chinese virologists and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill conduct unauthorized gain-of-function experiments on coronaviruses. This is why I say, you know, all this stuff was done years ahead of time, okay? So they're doing gain-of-function, and which I may have to modify my theory here, because if they're doing gain-of-function this far back and they're already starting vaccines, you know, in 2010 with Moderna, or maybe even earlier, then this whole thing, there might have been simultaneous development of viruses and vaccines, and at some point they kind of coordinated them. I'll keep investigating. You know, one should always be willing to take a look at your theories and evidence, and if you get new evidence, you know, you might have to create new theories. That's what I'm looking at right now. Okay, December 2019, Chinese authorities report the first outbreak of COVID-19 in Wuhan. Wait a minute. No, I think I skipped a year. All right. Let me backstep. Take two. All right. Let me just go back here. 2017. All right. So we had 2015. Chinese virologists are experimenting at Chapel Hill. 2017. Of course, this is when Trump takes office. All right. The 2005 Health and Human Services National Pandemic Plan is updated. Okay. This is what I told you about yesterday in great detail. April 21st, 3 months after Trump takes office, they completely changed the pandemic plan. Okay. That deserves a congressional investigation all by itself. Has one been done? No. In fact, Dr. Hatfield is the first person, other than, you know, yours truly, that's actually talked about the difference in these pandemic plans or that these pandemic plans exist at all. That in itself is fascinating, too. It didn't come up in the hearing yesterday or the day before, the House Select Committee hearing that I was listening to. Okay. I'm going to check it again. But basically, they're still looking at they're still at Wuhan. Okay. Wuhan's old news, folks. You're missing the boat if you're stuck at Wuhan. All right. Got to get with the program here. Program goes way back before Wuhan. Wuhan was just the place where they did the experiments after they were banned here. Then they moved into China. Of course, China said, hey, by the way, if you're going to do experiments in our lab, we're going to take it for bioweapons and give it to the Army. And so that's how that all works. All right. December 17th. Let me do this again just to make sure. 2005, Health and Human Services National Pandemic Plan is updated. That's where they removed the pandemic severity index. And I talked about that yesterday in great detail. The specific responsibilities of local authorities, states, and the federal government have been clearly stated. Okay, this is a good part of the plan. The national plan is to use early outpatient antiviral drug treatment, home quarantine, and case contact tracing to cover the vaccine gap. And that's the time needed to develop a vaccine to combat any pathogen, normally 10 to 15 years. for FDA approval. In an emergency, all bets are off. But think about this. National plan. So the plan actually was good. Outpatient antiviral drug treatment. That would be our two favorites, ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, both of which were, well, I don't know about ivermectin, but I know hydroxychloroquine specifically was banned, even though the national plan calls for an outpatient antiviral drug treatment. So there it is. It was in the plan. Hydroxychloroquine was in the plan. Okay. It was in the plan too, because, you know, it had to be used before experimental vaccines could be used. So they had to ban it. You know, they had to discredit it from the plan or not use it because of the plan and demonize and ban it, you know, in the FDA procedures in order to bring in their experimental vaccines. So this is why it's always been about vaccines. This is why I've said that for months, well, over a year now. Everything about COVID has to do with vaccines and about blocking everything else out. All right. December 2019, Chinese authorities report the first outbreak of COVID-19 in Wuhan. What a surprise, right by the lab. On January 21st, the first recognized case of COVID-19 occurs in the United States. February 2020, Dr. Stephen Hatfield, the person that wrote this letter, a specialist physician and recognized virologist, is brought into the White House as an outside medical advisor. Yeah, that's what Dr. Stephen Atlas brought into, and I'll talk about him as time goes on as well. All right. The letter goes on. Some members of the COVID-19 task force are considering the use of hydroxychloroquine, a safe and effective FDA-approved drug, to control the rapidly spreading pandemic. Well, of course, pandemics are rapidly spreading by definition, but I'll let that go. The drug proves to prevent hospitalization. Let me say that again. The drug proves to prevent hospitalization if taken when early symptoms of COVID-19 arise. This is the key sentence. The drug, well, it's one of them. The drug proves to prevent. You don't have to go, right? So this whole idea that what the FDA adopted in order to sell remdesivir and expensive treatments and all these other things was that they said there could be no treatments until you get to the hospital. Think about that. They actually put this forward, all right? This is that they changed the policy. Instead of having the prevention of hospitalization, which is the logical thing to do, all right, they actually said that you can't do any treatment, go home, wait till you're so sick you have to go on a ventilator. That was actually the policy. That's why so many people died. Okay, but it says right here in the national plan, drug proves to prevent hospitalization if taken when early symptoms of COVID-19 arise. The drug is cost effective at 60 cents per tablet. 60 cents, okay? All right, per tablet with COVID-19 treatment consisting of 11 tablets. 11 times 6 is 66. Okay, so $6.60, all right? So a week-long treatment of hydroxychloroquine, 11 tablets taken over 5 days, costs you $6.60. Remdesivir costs $3,200 plus a hospital visit, and it doesn't even work. Which would you rather take? 11 tablets of hydroxychloroquine over 5 days, or would you trust Dr. Fascist? You know, and wait until you're so sick you have to go to the hospital and be put on a ventilator. This is a no-brainer. But this is why these people are so guilty of just crimes against humanity. We'll talk about that later. Timeline goes on. He says some members of the COVID-19 task force are considering use of hydroxychloroquine. All right, I said that. The drug is cost. Okay, here we go. Here we go. Treatment of 11 tablets taken over 5 days. And here's another underlined sentence. The FDA, and I said this before, but it's in the letter here too. The FDA considers hydroxychloroquine to be a safer drug than Tylenol. Which begs the question, if the FDA says that hydroxychloroquine is safer than Tylenol, how could it be banned for COVID-19? Okay, this is a drug that can be taken, you know, the worst that can happen with hydroxychloroquine is nothing. Okay, so if you don't have an immune problem, if you don't have malaria, or you know, it's preventative against malaria, if it either cures or prevents COVID, and if you don't need COVID prevented, it still does nothing. See, preventives are things you take which don't do you any harm, but stop something else from happening to you that does do harm, okay? So that's what a preventive is. So if it's safe enough to be a preventive for all kinds of things, how can it be dangerous with, you know, as a treatment for COVID? That makes no sense. But none of this makes sense unless you realize it's all about the money, it's all about the profit, it's all about selling experimental vaccines and getting them on the market in a way that could never be done otherwise. And I explained this yesterday too, that in order to get an emergency declaration or a declaration of emergency, you have to have a pandemic. You know, a declaration of emergency allows you to have emergency use authorizations. You need emergency use authorizations to use experimental vaccines that aren't FDA approved. They're just authorized. Okay. So you see how it works? So they needed the pandemic to get the declaration of emergency. They needed the declaration of emergency to get the emergency use authorizations. They needed the emergency use authorizations to authorize the use of vaccines. They needed to demonize hydroxychloroquine and ban it because it was the alternative, the cheap and effective alternative to the vaccines. And by banning hydroxychloroquine, that allowed them to authorize the vaccines instead and make money. Got it? Back to the timeline. March 23rd, 2020, the director of – this is what's going to get a little complicated here. I know Jonathan's going to join us in a few minutes, but this is the key here. March 23rd, 2020, all right? This is into those 15 days to slow the spread, all right? Don't forget, I announced on March 2nd of 2020 that chloroquine cures COVID, and there's no reason for any kind of reaction to the pandemic because we already had the cure. That's how far ahead we were. All right. March 23rd, 2020, the director of BARDA, the Biological Advanced Research Development Authority, Rick Bright. I want you to think of, keep that name in mind, Rick Bright, B-R-I-G-H-T. He's a PhD, is instructed by his superiors to work with the FDA, that's the Food and Drug Administration, to establish an investigational new drug, that's an IND, authorization for hydroxychloroquine. Okay. The next day, the director of the Drug Evaluation and Research at the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, Dr. Janet Woodcock, contacts Rick Bright at BARDA. Okay. So this is going to be a little hard to follow, so I want to go over it a couple times. So Rick Bright is authorized by the FDA to create an authorization for hydroxychloroquine. The next day, he's contacted by Janet Woodcock, who's an MD at the Drug Evaluation and Research Department of the FDA. March 24th, the next day, Dr. Woodcock wrongly advises Dr. Bright, that hydroxychloroquine is a dangerous drug. We're requiring an emergency use authorization. Okay, think about that. Now, I'm sure she knows that was wrong. I'm sure she's part of the cabal that put this all together. But think about that. March 23rd, Rick Bright gets an authorization or gets an order to authorize hydroxychloroquine. The next day, Dr. Woodcock of the FDA wrongly advises Bright that hydroxychloroquine is a dangerous drug requiring an emergency use authorization, which, of course, is denied later on, right? Okay. It's back to the letter. Its use should be limited to hospitalized patients. And this is key, too. Bright and Dr. Woodcock promote this course of action despite the early clinical data showing that hydroxychloroquine was the most effective in outpatients if given early during initial infection, effectively eliminating hospitalization. Okay, here's what's going on. This I find fascinating and dangerous and scary and terrifying all at the same time. So Dr. Woodcock wrongly advises Rick Bright, who's a PhD, okay, that hydroxychloroquine is dangerous. Well, therefore he can't do his authorization for it because she says it's dangerous. So the FDA is not going to approve it, right? And then she says, this is Dr. Woodcock, Janet Woodcock, its use should be limited to hospitalized patients, okay? All right, so this is where it's so scary. Because then he says again, Bright and Dr. Woodcock promote this course of action despite the early clinical data showing hydroxychloroquine was the most effective in outpatients if given early during the initial infection, effectively eliminating hospitalization. So what it means is they wanted to take hydroxychloroquine and almost prove that it was ineffective by giving it at the wrong time, by saying you can't give it when it works, you can only give it when it doesn't work. Now, we later learned that massive doses of hydroxychloroquine do work in later stages, but we only found that out fairly recently. But this is back, you know, last year, all right? So think about that. They know hydroxychloroquine will prevent hospitalizations. They say you can't use it to prevent hospitalizations. You can only use it in the hospital when at that time it was thought when its effectiveness was radically reduced. So in other words, it's a setup, all right? This is misinformation. This is malpractice. This is as bad as it gets, all right? Saying that you can't use hydroxychloroquine at the time it's most effective. You can only use it when it's no good to prove that it doesn't work. And, of course, people died, all right? Let me go on. The FDA issues an EUA, that's an emergency use authorization, for hydroxychloroquine for hospital use only. So they followed the recommendation of Dr. Woodcock, all right? In a legal document, Rick Bright makes a blatant admission of insubordination to multiple layers of leadership, including the White House, HHS Secretary Azar, who's, you know, big pharma himself, and Dr. Robert Kadlec, the Assistant Health and Human Services Secretary for Preparedness and Readiness. Bright states the that's Rick Bright, states the following in his whistleblower complaint. So it looks like he's one of the good guys, all right? Instead of a nationwide expanded access IND protocol implementing the EUA, that's the Emergency Use Authorization, was a compromise position to rein in Health and Human Services leadership's initial campaign to make the drugs available to the public outside of a hospital setting. Okay, so he gets the word from Woodcock that you can only use this in the hospital. Rick Bright knows that it doesn't work in the hospital anywhere near as much as it works, you know, before you get to the hospital. So he makes a whistleblower complaint. Instead of a nationwide expanded access, you know, he says that he has to issue a compromise position that this drug can only be used in a hospital. So the question is that Dr. Stephen Hatfield is asking, and this, I know this is complicated. The question is, when is it ever acceptable to compromise public health during a rampaging pandemic? All right. A little bit more to go for this. And like I say, I'm expecting Jonathan to call in pretty much any time. But let me see if I can get through this as we go. April 4th, 2020, Dr. Anthony Fauci, MD, Dr. Fascist, the member of the COVID-19 task force responsible for informing the president of the best course of action for pandemic control, appears to be unaware, yeah, like hell, unaware of the national pandemic plan. In a heated White House Situation Room meeting, Dr. Fauci refused to consider the use of hydroxychloroquine for COVID-19 treatment. He dismisses the ever-accumulating hydroxychloroquine efficacy reports from China, South Korea, and France as simply anecdotal. Okay, now why would he do that? Why would Dr. Fascist, you know, dismiss the use of hydroxychloroquine? Because he knew damn well that he was working for Big Pharma, and that Big Pharma couldn't get their experimental vaccines as long as hydroxychloroquine was around. So he had to block hydroxychloroquine so that it couldn't be said that that an alternate treatment to the vaccines was available. Because without hydroxychloroquine, there's no alternative treatment available, and that's what allowed the use of vaccines. We've already covered this. Dr. Hatfield, I want to talk to him. I want to know how much he knows. Okay. April 22nd, 2020, Rick Bright is fired as BARDA director for his insubordination. So this proves he's one of the good guys. Unless you're fired from the government, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you haven't proven your worth. All right. Before his dismissal, he falsely informed the press that hydroxychloroquine is a dangerous drug. Okay, so you screwed up there, Rick. Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is not a virologist, you know, that's underlined, by the way, disregards the national pandemic plan, which included outreach programs with physicians using hydroxychloroquine for outpatient treatment and prevention to bring the COVID-19 pandemic under control. So in other words, advancing the pandemic. He's doing everything he can to make the pandemic get as bad as possible. All right. He's not doing anything to stop the pandemic, which hydroxychloroquine would have done, which is in the national pandemic plan, which includes the use of cheap and effective, you know, treatments to stop the pandemic, to stop you having to go to the hospital in the first place. Okay. You see how evil this man is? He actually stopped the cure to COVID and caused the deaths of 500,000 plus Americans. All right. So how do you bring this guy to justice? There is no punishment severe enough for him. There just isn't. You can't. Yeah. How do you bring someone to justice who willfully, consciously, psychopathically blocks every possible cure? And how about the ignorance and the negligence of the people involved, including the president, President Trump at the time? Talk about being duped. Let me go on. Dr. Fauci brushes off the accumulating evidence and diverts millions of federal funds into a program to test and manufacture an experimental drug. Here we go. Remdesivir. Remdesivir must be administered via IV and can only in the hospital. All right. Let me try this again. Remdesivir must be administered via IV and can only in the hospital. All right. I think you missed a word. It can only be given in the hospital. Dude, you got to proofread your stuff. Okay. Instead of early community treatment as prescribed in the original pandemic plan, Dr. Fauci changes the plan to promote societal lockdowns and push the development of highly experimental messenger RNA vaccines by multinational pharmaceutical corporations. Okay, let me spell this out as clearly as I can. The big pharma and the FDA, CDC, NIH that are invested in it, that make money from their investments, that make money from their royalties, that make money from their patents, that make money from however they're connected to big pharma, they don't make money on hydroxychloroquine. It's off patent. It's been around so long, there is no patent for it, okay? It's generically available. Well, not now because it's been banned, all right? So the treatment, the cheap, inexpensive treatment is banned so that big pharma and what I call the government industrial big pharma complex can make money off new and patentable drugs and therapies and vaccines. That's what it's all about. They want to sell the new stuff and ban the old stuff that's cheap and effective. Effectively, they have to promote and advance the pandemic. They have to block anything that will stop the pandemic in order to sell their new drugs. Is everybody getting this? All right. This is how evil they are. So doesn't it seem a little stupid and mindless and just a total waste to be worrying about the Wuhan lab at this point? This is where the investigation should be, into big pharma, into big government pharma. This is where you need to go. And the government's not doing it. I mean, they're starting to, this Republican hearing the other day, but we here at Action Radio are probably 6 months to a year ahead of what everybody else is thinking. Okay, this is where, and it's not just me. Okay, I don't want to sound arrogant. There's Dr. Hatfield's in on this as well. I'm going to talk to him. Dr. Zelenko, Dr. Raoul in France, Dr. Judy Mikovits, Dr. Simone Gold, Stella Emanuel, Dr. Stella Emanuel. You know, there are folks around the country that know about this, that are just screaming and yelling. It's like, why aren't you investigating these people? This is where the problem is. Okay. All right. So now you know. Now you know. Well, what the rest of the country is going to figure out in about 6 months to a year, hopefully. Note, members of Fauci's COVID-19 treatment panel have ties to Gilead Services. Gee, and what do they make? The company that holds the patent for remdesivir. What a friggin' surprise. All right. May 16, 2020, in phase one clinical trials conducted by Gilead Sciences in cooperation with China and Japan, remdesivir failed. No statistically clinical effect with severe adverse reactions. So the drug they were pushing failed. So what did they do? They kept pushing it. Why? Because it makes money. $3,200 versus $6.60 for a week-long treatment of hydroxychloroquine. So they're pushing a $3,200 failed treatment that you have to get by IV in the hospital over a $6.60 treatment that works perfectly. Well, I mean, not perfectly, but works in almost every case. All right? Fascinating. All right. I'm going to I want to just play something for a little bit here. And I got to check and see. Jonathan should have called me by now, so I want to check and see what's going on with that. So let me play you this, and I'll be right back.
Joe Biden's Dark Winter. No freedom, no liberty, no guns, no representation, no oil, no coal, no nuclear power, no space force, no constitution, no family gatherings, no vacations, just taxes. Work, misery, masks, lockdowns, and ever more government. This is what will happen if you let Marxists steal the election.
Let me play one more thing.
Public service announcement of Action Radio, reminding you it's time to get off your butt and save your country.
You know, I keep forgetting that part. I should play that more often. Let me play you my public service announcement, too, on the COVID vaccines, and I'll be right back as well.
This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio. You've all heard those ads for people who have suffered medical or health tragedies, which say you may be entitled to compensation. But if you have suffered injuries or crippling diseases or medical procedures that went horribly wrong, it's not the compensation you need, it's the knowledge you should have had before the condition you suffer from now. So that you are never in that position in the future, I strongly recommend that you do not get any COVID vaccines. Get informed. Do your own research. For 99.97% of Americans, your natural immunity will give you, at worst, only moderate symptoms of COVID. If you've already had COVID, it's virtually impossible to get it again. There are effective cures for COVID, which will get you completely over the virus. There is no cure for the COVID-19 vaccines. Once you start down the road of DNA modification, there is no going back.
Okay, let me just get a little bit more stuff here, and then hopefully Jonathan will be with us at this point, because we have a ton of things to talk about, legal world as well. All right, note, this is from Dr. Stephen Hatfield's letter to America. On October 16th, 2020, The Who concludes that remdesivir is an ineffective drug and does not recommend its use to treat COVID-19. So what happens? Well, of course, our folks here keep pushing it. Why? Because it makes money. All right. May 16, 2020, shortly after becoming senior medical advisor to the FDA, Commissioner Dr. Woodcock recused herself over future decisions concerning vaccines, citing a conflict of interest. Yeah, because she lied unbelievably. June 15, 2020, Dr. Fauci ignores the data that hydroxychloroquine works if the drug is administered during the first 5 days of infection. That came from Dr. Zelenko, who's my friend and, you know, someone that I met in the course of doing this show. I'll see if I can get on, back on, sort of give us an update where we stand with all this. Okay, so Dr. Fauci ignores the data on hydroxychloroquine. Its emergency use authorization is revoked despite the overwhelming evidence of its effectiveness. The FDA claims that hydroxychloroquine is causing fatal heart rhythms in hospitalized patients when the COVID-19 virus itself is the cause. So there you go. So they said the cure was causing heart problems. They're also giving massive doses way too much, way too late, if I remember this correctly. June 19th, 2020, Dr. Fauci recommends a $1.6 billion purchase of remdesivir despite the drug's phase one failure in China. So here's the question. Why did Dr. Fauci discredit hydroxychloroquine, leaving us defenseless, and order $1.6 billion of an ineffective and toxic drug? I know why. Because it makes money. That's the, follow the money. It's the answer to everything. Almost done. Jonathan's online. I'll get right to him in a second. Dr. Fauci's actions paved the way for the fast-track development of experimental messenger RNA vaccines and the subsequent patents. There you go. That's where the money is, which can only receive an emergency use authorization, quote, underline, if no other approved and effective medicine like outpatient, you know, hydroxychloroquine exists, which, of course, they do. This is why they had to ban it. See how it works? You ban the cure and you promote the expensive treatment that nobody knows, you know, what's going to happen. Of course, people are dying by the thousands. All right. Last one here. After widespread lockdowns and millions of global deaths, the experimental messenger RNA vaccines are granted an emergency use authorization and released to the public. As of the date of this letter, and that was June 19th, the pandemic still prevails and there is no FDA-approved outpatient treatment for COVID-19. Think about that. Yeah, June 8th, 2021. That's a letter from Stephen Hatfield. In the interest of time, I will skip Jonathan's theme this week, and let's get him on and let's start talking. Jonathan, I don't know how much you're able to follow my earlier comments, but that letter by Stephen Hatfield is devastating. What do you think?
No, it is. I heard the last of it, and you know, I've always thought that this is the kind of thing that they can't keep quiet forever, particularly. Other countries are not going to sacrifice their citizens for an American bureaucrat like Fauci. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a limit to which this can be kept under wraps for so long. And,
well, my contention is we're still looking in the wrong places, and it's a waste of time to be going at Wuhan when these people are guilty as hell. And I proved this over several shows. You take yesterday's timeline, you take today's letter with Dr. Hatfield, and it's obvious that they banned hydroxychloroquine so they could get an emergency use authorization for their experimental vaccines, because hydroxychloroquine treatment is $6.60, and the vaccines, they've made billions, billions upon billions of dollars in profit off that.
Yes, we've had allegations like this for a long time, but this is the clearest example that we've ever had that's actually for real. And it's very disturbing.
So from a legal aspect, what would you classify the crime? Is it genocide? Is it mass malpractice? It's not negligence, because they knew what they were doing. This is premeditated. So how do you go after these people in terms of criminal law?
Something that can be dealt with by negligence is not defeated by the fact that it's a little bit too, you know, they weren't clueless. It could still be an intentional tort, or it could still qualify as this. But I don't know off the top of my head, because you have these government things, but the people could. You know, a lot of families could be suing for wrongful death.
Okay.
And they tend to immunize government, which is part of the problem. But they should certainly be trying. And you know, I don't know. I haven't really thought about it in these terms quite yet.
Well, I think about this
stuff
over months.
Government. Well, yeah. You probably go after a conspiracy.
Okay.
Because this is probably a conspiracy with the private companies,
mm-hmm.
right?
Oh, I guarantee
and,
it. You know, as everything I've said points to the fact that that the private companies and Dr. Fascist and all these folks cooperated to basically create a pandemic, to create a declaration of emergency, to create emergency use authorizations, and they had to ban hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, anything that would work, so that they could say that nothing else works, and they could bring in their experimental, profitable, new patented vaccines. That's what I think happened.
Well, those who worked on creating the vaccine, creating the virus, may even be guilty of murder, and you know, at least manslaughter, and that can be part of a that could be part of a wrongful death action and a class action one as well. Larry Klayman has sued on the basis of it being a biological weapon,
mm-hmm.
And also their failure to cooperate with information under the biological weapon treaties. But there could be class actions for the death of loved ones. That's what wrongful death is, brought by family members of someone who's died. And anyway, so no, I think that's pretty serious stuff.
Okay.
I don't have a lot of time today, unfortunately. I've got an appraiser coming like at 9:15 here. let me
switch
if you can.
Yeah, whatever you want to talk about is fine. Yeah, we don't need all the, you're on the air. It's kind of funny.
So
yeah.
I assume that, you know, for now, I mean, yes, the last topic should be pursued, but I'm not sure what else to say. You know, and I do want to get to the next thing, which is that we're told, well, first of all, we're told that the Trump Organization is, mm-hmm. Has been indicted. And that Alan Weisselberg, the chief financial officer of the Trump Organization for decades, has been indicted. Now, I want to help people get the playbill here of, the program of what's going on here, is that everything we think we know as of now is a Class E felony under New York law. It's the crime of unlawful grand jury disclosure. So everything you're reading in the newspaper and everything that's going on there, every detail of that, someone committed a felony to disclose what we're hearing. So we don't know, for reality, what's actually going to happen. But so now, if you believe the New York Times, if the New York Times is accurate, you know, it might be the first time this year that they're accurate, but what they reported this morning was that Alan Weisselberg, the chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, reported, to turn himself in at the district attorney's office at 6:20 a.m. and last, there were all these articles about that he may be indicted soon. They may be indicted soon, and then there started to be reports late last night. You got to watch here, because a lot of these are the echo chamber.
Mm-hmm.
As the same story gets told and retold, it can get changed like a telephone game. So whether there was actually any sourcing that an indictment has occurred, could just be the same story echoing through the news media echo chamber. But the reports came out late last night that the indictments had happened and would be unsealed today, Thursday. And in response, I think, to that, Alan Weisselberg turned himself in at 6:20 a.m. Now, that's kind of interesting in itself, because it's sort of in your face. I mean, it could be consistent with Alan Weisselberg is cooperating with the district attorney, because why would you turn yourself into the district attorney's office as opposed to the police or the court? Well, the court's not open at 6:20 a.m., and so he could have been doing it to avoid, photographs and everything. But presumably this means that there were reporters staking it out anyway, or, again, another Class E felony from the prosecutor's office. Because here's what they're saying is, what the leaks are, is that The indictment is, there has been an indictment, and it will be unsealed probably later this afternoon. Well, that means it's not been unsealed, which means they're committing a crime. And if Trump had real lawyers, he would be they would be moving to dismiss on the basis of prosecutorial misconduct. You know, Larry Klayman would do that if you woke him up in the middle of the night. You know, he would say, you know, have you thought about a motion to dismiss for prosecutorial misconduct?
Sure, because how do you know what's in a sealed document? The whole point of a sealed document is that it's sealed. You don't know what's in it.
and the very purpose of the laws against revealing grand jury information is to protect people's reputations. So all of these smears, you know, again, you know, there's a different rule for Trump. So,
well, there's a different rule for the leakers,
so
too.
That, but presumably.
But
what?
Just a question real quick. The leakers, you know, because who would prosecute the people that are leaking? I assume the leaks are coming from the prosecutors themselves or their minions in the office there. And the prosecutors are not going to prosecute their own staff for leaking things that they want leaked, even though they know it's illegal to have them leaked because they control who gets prosecuted.
Yeah, but they,
right?
Well, they know it, but they don't care. But the
right.
thing is that yes, they'd have to appoint an outside prosecutor or bring somebody in from another part of New York State.
Okay. The Democrat
to prosecute them, but the thing is that our guys should be on, you know, on offense about this. But so anyway, so what we think is happening is that Cy Vance, the attorney, the district attorney for New York County, has been trying to get Alan Weisselberg to turn on the Trump Organization and Trump and tell what he wants. If he knew anything he could tell, you know, he would have the problem is when you go this far and you squeeze somebody this far, you have to confront the possibility that he doesn't know anything. He says, but no, we know that Trump has to be corrupt. Well, you know, that's just bias and bigotry. But if
wishful thinking.
That,
it's guilt by wishful thinking is what it is. We've talked about that.
Yeah, that's a very good phrase. That's a very good phrase. But
you can
like,
use it.
You know, and everybody talks about, like, not just with Trump, but with other people, that the prosecutor is trying to get someone to flip. Well, the prosecutor is always trying to get somebody to flip. I mean, that's a constant. And the thing is, you can't get somebody to flip if the target didn't do anything, or if the person doesn't know anything about it. Now he's the CFO, but again, the CFO doesn't necessarily, you know, do all the things. I mean, in a big organization, the CFO might not, you know, work on something. So what do we think? As we've talked about a little bit before, this has come down to is fringe benefits. Now, which is really interesting because somebody once said a long time ago, thank you for my enemies because they are dumb. The thing here is that, what? I don't know. I don't remember, but maybe I'm misquoting a little bit, but that's, I have to go look that up. But the thing is that the only thing he's come down to, at least by the rumors, is fringe benefits, which means that Cy Vance just made enemies of all of Wall Street and the entire business community nationwide because they're criminalizing the only thing that really matters to business executives is, you know, their money and their pay and their, you know, compensation package. So now the thing is, there are fringe benefits that sometimes are disqualified. For example, if you do certain things and you don't give it to everybody and things like that, there are technicalities. But those technicalities are so difficult and so obscure that you can't prosecute somebody for getting it wrong. Furthermore, again, Trump doesn't do his own taxes. He's got people who are experts in taxes doing this stuff. So, you know, there's this. But I would like people to listen if they can care. If they, you know, whether you like Trump or not, think about this. Do you get health insurance from your employer? That's the same thing that they're accusing Trump of. did you pay taxes on your health insurance from your employer? Maybe your employer pays part of your health insurance or all of it. Those are fringe benefits. And they're, and at least based on the rumors, they're accusing the Trump Organization of not paying taxes on these fringe benefits. That's the whole point of fringe benefits. It's not like it's a feature, not a bug. To not pay taxes is the reason why there are fringe benefits, why they were created. Long, you know, it's like to say that, you know, that airplanes fly or something. So they're accusing them of committing a crime by doing what fringe benefits do. And like I say, you don't pay. The company can deduct the cost of health paying health insurance from their taxes, and the employee doesn't pay income on the health insurance. Like, is anybody listening who, when they did their income tax, they put down the fringe benefits like health insurance, mm-hmm. life insurance, whatever contributions to pensions. And did you pay taxes on the value of the health insurance you got from your employer, even if it's only a partial payment? So that's what they're going after him on. Now again, the part of this apparently comes out of his daughter's divorce, her Alan Weisselberg's son's divorce. And a lot of information, and they say that, you know, they'll say that, oh, that Cyrus Vance got all these treasure trove of documents from the divorce. Well, you know, if the prosecutor asks for documents, he's going to get them. That doesn't mean anything. But apparently they got, you know, this information about how they were living in an apartment rent free or something like that, getting his granddaughter's tuition paid for.
Yeah, I think we're getting the details, and it looks to me like they're just looking for a way to see his taxes. They want to go on a fishing expedition, and so they're making all this stuff up. Now, as I understand health insurance, it's a benefit. You still may have to pay for part of it, you know, a shared cost, but you're not paying the taxes on the benefit. And if I remember rightly, this came about during World War II. When companies had limited funds, things crashed, and they had only so much money. And the way that they wanted to attract, you know, better employees was to offer things without having to pay money on them, because there was only so much going around at that time. So they offered health benefits. And so they would pay the benefits, and they would get the tax deduction. And the employee would get the benefit without having extra income, you know, so they wouldn't have to pay taxes on their income. This would be a benefit. And that's the difference between income and benefits, and that makes perfect sense, okay? So you fast forward to today. I'm wondering why employees can't, you know, pay the cost and get their own health insurance, you know, and then get the tax benefits themselves. Well, you know, why can't we move to a plan like that?
We should, and we can, because the downside of this,
mm-hmm.
in all the health insurance thing, Hillary Care, and all these kinds of things, is the idea that it inadvertently ties an employee's hands to staying with the company.
And the company dictates your plan. Yeah, rather than you doing it.
Right. But, you know, because you'll have an interruption and all kinds of things like that, and they get group rates, and if you go out on your own, you can't get their group rates. And now suddenly this thing that we all talked about, you know, way back in the 90s and since ever, forever about this thing, this is abusive Trump. Trump is like giving people fringe benefits to tie their hands to work for him. You know, now the same Democrats used to be saying that about every company with healthcare in general, because they're just fringe benefits. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
And but now it's like Trump is a tyrant. And, we won't know what's actually in the indictment until probably Thursday. I know I've emailed Juan Fischetti, the lawyer who's finally gotten out and talking about this and written about it. And you know, I would hope that they would have a motion to quash based on the statute of limitations. I was starting to say that the divorce was in 2018, and typically that would involve, you know, documents going back years earlier. So there's a good chance that
some or all of this is outside the statute of limitations, which is maybe why they switched to the fringe benefit thing. But,
yeah.
But after all this, again, all this buildup, you know, attacking people's fringe benefits is just ham-handed and once again is stupid and is going to get, you know, the entire business community on Trump's side, even though they're going to hate it. But, you know, they love themselves more than they hate Trump.
Yeah.
So it's really a strange thing.
Well, I got a question before we tackle another topic, because, like I say, I don't know how much time you have, but I know you have to go in about, 10, 15 minutes. But Cyrus Vance, is that the son of Cyrus Vance, who was Jimmy Carter's Secretary of State? And how connected to the deep state is this Cyrus Vance? I mean, who else would name their kid Cyrus Vance? I mean, the chances are infinitesimal.
I mean, I don't personally know, but I would assume that he's as connected as you get. I mean,
okay.
He probably wouldn't have gotten elected without the help of his father's connections, and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I'm just wondering, because if I remember, Cyrus Vance actually had a little integrity. Cyrus Vance Sr., you know, in Jimmy Carter's administration, when Carter boycotted the Olympics, I think Cyrus Vance resigned over that, the Russian Olympics. And so he left, but he seemed like the decent one. And the kid seems like the opportunist. It's just like Mario Cuomo was a real firebrand of a Democrat, but he seemed to me a decent guy. His son, Andrew Cuomo, is a spoiled brat opportunist. You know, it's just it seems to run that the next in line, you know, tend to have the worst possible characteristics. They're privileged. They're the elites. They're the deep state. You know, do you see a pattern among Democrats in this way? Then we can talk about Rudy Giuliani's kid. I find that interesting too. But yeah, Andrew Cuomo and this guy.
I mean, go back to
Cy Vance Jr.
Things.
Yeah,
absolutely. And bear in mind too that when people are committing Class C felonies by leaking this information. It might not be Cy Vance personally. It might be some eager young prosecutor who sees that the boss is retiring at the end of this year, and he wants to make himself feel important or be important to, you know, to his next gig, and he figures nobody's going to hold him accountable for it.
Or just take one for the team kind of thing. This is crazy.
Well,
hey,
yeah.
I've got a bunch of issues that I want to know, but I want to make sure, do you have any other topic burning that we want to get to? Otherwise, I've got a couple of questions.
No, I have a lot of time. But go ahead.
All right. So the big one right now for me especially, because I want to sue the hell out of Facebook, is that this judge, you know, put our censorship bill on hold. Do you know anything about that?
Well, a little bit. I haven't studied the opinion, but I do, you know, in general, what happens with the district court, you know, the first level, people really shouldn't pay that much attention to it. Because it, you know, especially if it's at all novel, it's not going to get worked out until it gets to the appeals court. And hopefully, now you have, I have to check your appeals. You're in the 11th Circuit. It's not one of the worst, but I don't know if it's one of the better ones. Larry Klayman would know. And I think that, you know, I don't know, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court is playing dodgeball, and trying to, you know, the problem is it's like from the movie Clear and Present Danger, where James Earl Jones's character tells, Harrison Ford's character, you were trying to impress, you know, he got into trouble. You were trying to impress the president. You shouldn't do that. The U.S. Supreme Court, when it's trying to be popular, makes, you know, what the British call a pig's breakfast of it. You know, they should just follow the Constitution instead of you know, trying to pander and be popular. They, you
well,
know,
I got an article
is,
here
they
if,
are,
if you want some details, you know, so if you're curious.
Well, I did read about it, but I'd want to see what I understand is is that the big tech. It struck me that the issues were weak, because they were trying to say that the law forces Facebook or whatever to speak, You know, you can't, you know, the jurisprudence in the First Amendment is that you can't censor, you can't, the government cannot prohibit somebody from speaking, and the government cannot put something in somebody's mouth to say you are required to say this, which is what's going on in the school board thing about pronouns and things in Loudoun County. It's like you can't force people to get express messages they don't agree with. And they're saying, well, that's what the law does to Facebook, which obviously it does not.
Yeah.
It provides an equal forum. It's transparently obvious that they're not the ones speaking, not because it's tangential, you know, not because, because that's the core of what Facebook pretends to be. It's not like it's an incidental, again, it's not a bug. It's a feature that allows you to speak. So to say that the law is forcing them to say things is just simply ridiculous, because it's a form. It's like saying that the telephone company is required to espouse opinions it doesn't agree with because you're making a phone call.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no, they're providing a phone service. They're not in.
We have
no,
a cure for this.
They're not in.
Our bill. What? You know, creating a wall of separation and basically rewriting Section 230 would have taken care of this. And we've got the solution.
Yeah.
You know, and this is the crazy part. This is the most frustrating thing in the world for me, is that I know what the solution is. I wrote it. It's right there. Anybody can read it.
Yeah.
Here's what I got from this article.
That's been my life, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I understand.
To listen.
We'll get there.
Too much of Washington, as I've said, is the political world is, you know, we don't call us, we'll call you. Our role is exalted, you know, Zod, whatever, is to tell you what to think. But we're not going to listen. So that's a big problem. And to the point where try to get in contact information for some of these guys. They don't want to be contacted. But anyway, that's another thing. So the thing is, we are going to that's going to go up on appeals for sure, and then we'll see.
Well, I say the problem
well, then
for
again,
me.
Comes, we spent a lot of time trying to dodge. I mean, part of it too is the idea that the federal Section 230, because the federal law will preempt the state law. And we've acknowledged that this is a problem, but it helps that somehow or other the social media have managed to anger both the right and the left. So that's kind of an interesting thing.
Well, it's an interesting article. This is news that I've never seen before. World breaking news. You know, and they actually have this in their entertainment section, which I find interesting. But it says in the preliminary injunction issued on Wednesday, the judge sided with the two trade associations, read lobbying groups, that argued parts of the law may violate the First Amendment by requiring social media sites to host speech they otherwise would not, and by interfering with their editorial judgment. Well, that makes them publishers, okay? Which the law specifically says they're not. So that's a wrong decision right there.
First of all, it reminds me that the trade associations don't have standing. They should be thrown out on standing grounds. And on the other hand, they're not supposed to be making editorial decisions.
Exactly.
That's not their business.
Yeah.
Their business is, you know, it's interesting because Facebook is spending gobs of money advertising that internet regulations need to be updated. I don't know what they're thinking.
Yeah.
Because they're just inviting what they don't want. But the thing is that, you know, their Section 230 was created on the guy's idea that they don't get to make decisions. It's all about where they allow access to other people. But as soon as they, as you said, that makes them a publisher, which means that their business model is not a news site. You know, if this were Drudge Report, then who has turned totally rhino establishment these days.
I've read it for years. It's gone. Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing is that if, if they pick and choose what news they want to put up there, that's their business model. Fine. you know, you don't join them to give your speech, and they don't have to. But as soon as at Facebook, that's not their business model. You know, Facebook began, as we'll say, as Zuckerberg putting up pictures of girls on campus and asking the men to rate which one they'd like to bang. And that's the result. This is the guy who wants to tell us what to think and tell us who, you know, how our ethics, and wants to guide us. And we're supposed to believe what, you know, it's like, well, Facebook has this message. Click here to find out more about this. Why would I listen to you about anything? But their model is to let, you know, is to attract, have users.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to get around to, and really they're, one of the things that I'm trying to do is that their terms of service use all this flowery language, which basically means that they have given a contract for you to be able to voice your opinions.
Mm-hmm.
And they're breaking their contract, which is what I've got to sit down as soon as I finish selling this house and do a lawsuit for a candidate and see if I can use it for you too. Anyway, because I've been painting and my appraiser is supposed to come here at 9:15, so which is now, so we'll have to revisit that. But those are all some things. So we need to, you know, we will know a lot more this afternoon when there's an arraignment.
Okay.
Of the Trump Organization, and then they'll unseal the document. And if Trump's attorneys are worth their salt, they will be pleading statute of limitations. You know, are you guilty or are you not guilty? Statute of limitations, Your Honor. We're done here. We can all go home. You know, and again, you know, most lawyers I know, even if it didn't work, they'd still do that because it sets the tone. Anyway, I got to go.
Well, thank you so much. And I have a ton of questions for you. We'll pick them up next week. Here we go. Jonathan Mosley
right,
has
great.
To leave
Thanks.
Us now. All right.
Okay,
you take care. Thank you. I got so many questions on the Massachusetts tax case. I've got questions on this. I pulled up our bill on rewriting Section 230 on censorship and everything else. I got Claire on the line too. So before I start with Claire, I know she's listening. So we're going to be back in about 6 minutes. So what I want to do, if you want to call right back, that's fine. If you want to stay on mute, that's fine too. But I can bring you on because I want to play our daily special, which is our Founding Moments, sponsored by the Santa Rosa Volunteers, which is our new sponsor here at Action Radio. And so this is it speaks for itself, but it's on the Declaration of Independence, which we are all going to read tomorrow. And Claire's going to be joining us for that as well. So busy week here on Action Radio. I'm going to take about a 6 minute time to play you this, and I'll be back after that. Oh, let's get the button going here. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. With July 4th coming up Sunday, I have to say something about the Declaration of Independence. Everyone knows the beginning words of the Declaration. We even have a Founding Moments on it. But the bulk of the Declaration consists of 27 grievances, some of which are just as applicable as a grievance today against our own federal government as they were against England when we were colonies. How could this happen? We have a Constitution. But constitutions are only as valid as the oath people swear when they promise to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Let me highlight just a few of the grievances that are every bit as valid today as they were in 1776 and for exactly the same reasons. When the Declaration says he, that's King George III. He today would be the entire federal government. He has refused his assent to laws, the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. Laws today are for special interests and more government power. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance.
The greatest danger we face is an out-of-control federal bureaucracy of endless officers, agencies, and departments. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. This is done today because Congress has delegated almost all their power to declare war to the president, something they have no power to do. He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation. Today, that would be international law, international courts, treaties or agreements not ratified by the Senate, climate accords, the United Nations, and all their various agencies. For imposing taxes on us without our consent. Did you know that the income tax and the withholding of money from your paycheck used to be unconstitutional? All kinds of taxes, fees, and burdens are placed on us, many of which are hidden. For depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury. We have plea bargains, uninformed jurors, corruption, money, prosecutorial misconduct, administrative trials and judges, and a multitude of judicial actions that do not involve a jury of our peers. Juries are never of our peers, either. For taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our governments. Today, that would be abandoning the Constitution and governing by whatever the leftist deep state wants. For suspending our own legislatures and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. This would be all the governors, mayors, public health officials, and Dr. Fauci himself taking over our government during a bogus pandemic of their making, stealing our rights, imposing illegal lockdowns and mask mandates not based on any science, and simply declaring whatever orders they wanted with no legislature or due process at all. It's still going on. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. This could happen if the government takes our guns, which is why I say, except for the military, we need to take their guns. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. Today, you can see how Black Lives Matter, Antifa, the FBI, and other rioting mercenaries of the deep state are being used to enforce Marxist theories like critical race theory and climate change, not to mention the false pandemic of COVID, which are all designed to create fear, depression, hopelessness, compliance, conformity, groupthink, and political correctness, all for the state. So just substitute Indians for all the groups in and out of government that are being used by government against us, and this problem is exactly the same. So the question is, what are your grievances, and what are you going to do about it? I created Action Radio so that we the people could write the laws we consent to be governed by and reverse the process where they, the government, order us to comply with their laws, orders, and decisions. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. The movies have James Bond. But we have Claire Lopez. Does she drive an Aston Martin, fly to resorts on the French Riviera, and chase bad guys like Ernst Stavro Blofeld and Goldfinger? No, but she was a career officer with the CIA. Claire is an expert on the former Soviet Union, Central and Eastern Europe, and the Balkans. She speaks Spanish, Bulgarian, French, German, Russian, and is studying Farsi. Claire is documenting the cabal of the Muslim Brotherhood, Black Lives Matter, and Antifa. She is also describing how China is turning us into yet another property owned by the Chinese Communist Party. And now, Claire Lopez with the Intelligence Report on Action Radio.
So we go from the serious to the silly. We cover it all here. Good morning, Claire. How are you today?
Hey, good morning, Greg, and everybody on. Glad to be with you.
Well, thanks for your patience for working through our report. And this is something that's new to Action Radio. We do have a sponsor, and they keep asking for, you know, they said founding moments. Just do a minute or so on our founding documents. And I can't do a minute. I don't feel any, there's no way you can do this with justice. I'll probably do like three or four reports on each of our founding Federalist Papers, for example. But you can't say I don't take a position. So agree or disagree, you know, I'm going to present my point of view. And you're going to be joining us tomorrow, it looks like, for our reading, hopefully, unless the schedule does not permit.
Well, and okay, by the way, I very much enjoy these minutes or couple of minutes that you do on the following documents. Those are really nice.
Well, thank you. Yeah, they're available. I'm going to start to post the times that I post them, but what I think I'll probably do is put together links of all of them and just put them all on they're all MP3, uh-huh. So they're easy to upload, download, and I can share them. You know, I can always send them to you, you know, directly if you want as well, and I'll do that for any listener, you know, who we have a new public email, greg@writeyourlaws.com, so anybody can contact me there. Did you have a comment on anything that I said as far as the declaration goes or any comments you might have on it in general?
Not especially, but I was just really looking forward to celebrating our 4th of July Independence Day weekend this weekend.
Yeah. Yeah, that's going to be fun. I know the fireworks have been canceled at Mount Rushmore, and the Biden insurrection is doing everything possible to almost make us dependent. It seems like a contradiction. The Democrats want you dependent. They're trying for a certain percentage of vaccinations and compliance with all their laws, and it's the most un-American Independence Day, you know, from their perspective. But Americans, we're just rebellious. I mean, this is what caused us to be independent in the first place, that we said, basically, screw you. We're going to celebrate anyway. You know, we're going to do our fireworks. We're going to have our fun. We're going to have our barbecues. And we're not going to comply with all this, these, you know, endless mandates. And that I think is to our credit.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And I'll tell you, I've been traveling around the country these mm-hmm. last few weeks as the country begins to open back up again to speak at different places, and I have a few mm-hmm. more places I'll be going in coming weeks, including back to my home state of Ohio and also back out to my fast becoming new favorite state of Oklahoma, where I've been several times. And then come August, I'll be out in California. So seeing a good, you know, part of the country. And I'll tell you, the spirit of the people out there, the grassroots, everyday American patriot citizens out there is just so inspiring to see, so encouraging. I want to go more.
Well, what's causing you to do these speeches? Are you doing these on your own? Is there a group that's sponsoring it? How did this come about?
They're different in each case, different people, okay. Different groups.
Wow. See, I'd love to have all your videos. I mean, I've seen some of them, but in the same way, I can put together my founding moments. If you have a compilation of your videos, we do have an Action Radio video page where you can post all your videos or any of that you have of speeches that you've done, because you're kind of a national treasure all by yourself here with all the things that you know. Never ceases to amaze me how much you do know. It's kind of scary, actually. But, so definitely feel free to do that.
Yeah. Everything is not always videotaped, but for those that are, I can send them to you, yeah.
Okay, that'd be great, yeah. I'm interested in your viewpoint, and especially when you come back from California, because I left California. One of the main reasons was I wanted to try a different part of the country. I've been there 30 years, and what I saw was that it didn't matter how much I tried or how much I fought or how much I, you know, screamed and yelled and complained, how many articles I wrote. You know, whether I got into radio in California, which I was in the Bay Area, so that was going to be virtually impossible anyway. You know, you can only fight so long until you realize it's not going to happen here. I needed to go somewhere else, which is why I looked for stations, you know, around the country. Unfortunately, found one where I did want to live, which is in the Panhandle of Florida. And so that worked out really well. But, you know, the coastline of California, and California in general, which parts are you going to? Because the coastline, the liberal coastline, is very different than the conservative middle and the very conservative northern part, which would love to form their own state of Jefferson if given the chance. Which part of California are you headed for? Yeah.
Well, I will tell you, Santa Barbara, I now think Santa Barbara and Ventura County, which is sort of right next door.
Mm-hmm.
You might think about these as, you know, heartland of you know, a blue California. But what first drew me to that area, mm-hmm. or at least to a focus on it, and trips now too, were the parents. The parents of students in the local school systems who all had been stuck at home, the students and the parents alike, over the last mm-hmm. year or so,
mm-hmm.
and for the first time, parents looking over the shoulders of their kids doing remote learning on a laptop on the kitchen table, began to see what those kids were being taught. And they didn't know, or they hadn't known before then. And they were appalled, they were horrified, and they were furious. And I'm mm-hmm. talking about ethnic studies programs, I'm talking about critical race theory. And so last year, I began to write a series, which you have, of articles at Front Page Magazine about critical race theory, but specifically what is going on in California. And
yep.
then spread to the rest of the country, which is what it's done, of course. But I wrote four articles in that series last year and another four in that series this year, all of which you have. I sent them all to you,
mm-hmm.
About what is critical race theory, what parents have learned about it, what has made them so furious about it, and what the connections are among the roots of critical race theory. Where did it come from? Of course, Marxism. It's Marxism coming, eventually you go back far enough to the 1917 revolution in Russia, and even further back, of course, to Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
But then how critical race theory got a grip on academia in America, spread from leftist, communist faculty lounges of universities all throughout the academic system, meaning on down, you know, K through 12,
mm-hmm.
And across the country. And then now, to bring it up to date, you know, how parents are becoming aware, just a blooming, a blossoming of awareness over the last several months that's amazing to see. And then, of course, the pushback. So that's in a nutshell what brought me to California. And it happened just because I have friends out there. That's really how it started.
Fascinating.
With
go ahead. Yeah. Well, you just got cut off there. What was the last thing you said?
Oh, I was saying my friends out there are people with kids in the school system.
Okay, got it. That makes sense. Yeah. California is a very interesting place. It still is a pioneering place. There's still an entrepreneurial American spirit there, but it's being so suppressed by the Gavin Newsom, who I believe is Nancy Pelosi's nephew, if I remember correctly. So he's into the power structure.
Yeah.
He's deep state.
Yeah.
He's part of the entrenched, you know, elite order, at least they think they are. But what's fascinating about California is the pioneers that are still there. Now, for me, it wasn't going to work. You know, if I had a huge radio show and I could influence millions of people, yeah, I probably would have stayed. But being here in Florida is such a sympathetic, wonderful crowd. And I went from, you know, a socialist bastion to, you know, military, you know, freedom enclave here in the panhandle. It's night and day. And people don't realize what the contrasts are around the country unless you get around and start traveling. So do you find in California that there are those who, you know, I don't know how much you meet or talk to the people that really believe in the socialist oppression, critical race theory, and all those kind of things to create this socialist utopia. But I bet you meet a lot of parents, you know, especially the friends that you're talking about, who are dead set against this, who have absolutely no idea this was being done. And this great awakening has occurred. So if any one good thing has come out of the lockdowns and mask mandates, it's the fact that the teachers' unions insisted that the schools be closed so they could make money for doing nothing, and that parents got to see what the kids were being taught, which then leads to the question, why didn't the parents know what their kids were being taught? We'll let you expand on that.
Well, I mean, you know, let's cut the parents a little bit of slack here because
okay.
they were busy, you know, very often working one job, maybe two jobs, mom, dad, you know, they trusted the school system, in short. They trusted you know, the government, the public school system, they trusted whatever private schools they had their children in, because they're teaching some of this stuff too. And they didn't realize. I mean, I cut the parents some slack. They were trying to keep their families together and pay the mortgage and everything else. But it was only, like you said, a little bit of a silver lining to the big cloud of the last year and months, you know, that had the parents at home and the kids at home in a situation where the parents could see and did see. It's not that they're not interested. They're very much interested, and ever more so now than yeah. before. But they just didn't have the opportunity and the time before.
Interesting. Yeah, I raised a daughter in California. That's why I stayed, you know, as long as I did. And she was fortunate enough to go to a private school where we knew what the curriculum was very clearly, because they talked about it, sent it out, and it was very obvious what my daughter was being taught. However, in the public schools, I'm wondering, do they do that same thing? And should this be something we should be looking into at Action Radio to make sure that government schools are sending out accurate lesson plans, curricula, synopsis of what the courses are, especially, I guess, junior high and high school when they get more specialized. How much information were the parents getting from the school themselves before the lockdowns? I'm just curious.
Oh, it's my impression, at least, that not very much.
Okay.
No, I mean, schools are under no particular obligation to send that kind of material home. Now, some schools may and do, mm-hmm. and others don't. But when it really came to public attention was, yes, over the kitchen table, mm-hmm. but also as at the state level, or maybe the school board level, let's say, there were initiatives being promoted to actually push through, you know, new mandates for ethnic studies and critical race theory that hadn't been there before. And yeah. and with those sort of public initiatives, it came more to the public, parents' attention. And then I have to give, you know, a tip of the hat to some really good work done by a couple of folks, Christopher mm-hmm. Rufo, of course, whom everybody has heard of, and then also James Lindsay. The two of these really publicized what was going on with some of these new curriculum initiatives that included critical race theory. And, you know, thanks to the news programs that actually did have them on, mm-hmm. Tucker Carlson comes to mind, Newsmax as well, had these two on, Christopher Rufo and James Lindsay. And that's another way that the word about this got out.
Yeah, actually, I haven't heard of these people, so I'm just writing them down right now. Yeah, it's amazing. I've been so immersed in the whole COVID thing that's been dominating most of my attention for a long time. When a program like this comes out, Critical Race Theory, how does it get to your you know, suburban government school? Are teachers told this is your new program, you have to teach this? You know, do the school boards? You know, my impression is the school boards have this attitude that we know better than you. We know better than the parents. You know, shut up. Let us teach your kids. You know, just shut up and go away is what I think is happening. And the parents are like, no, we're not going to shut up. We're not going to go away. In fact, we're going to run against you and replace you, which I think is another fascinating development. But for a teacher, for the average teacher, you know, especially one that might object to this kind of thing, how do the schools introduce something like critical race theory into the curriculum? And how much do they just mandate it or how much the teachers actually voluntarily do it because they want to, because they have a leftist persuasion anyway, to get into the system?
Well, very often this kind of an initiative comes at the school board level.
Okay.
And that would be at the county level in our various states, introduced, you know, by leftist Marxists on the school board.
Okay.
And again, very much depending on the area. I think I've said this before, but sometimes school boards are elected. Their members are elected by the local county, and mm-hmm. sometimes they're appointed, and that just differs from place to place across the country. But in places where they're elected, you know, very often the election of those members reflects, you know, the leftist, Marxist, communist leaning of the population in the county. Other times it does not. And in particular, in places where There might be a low voter turnout or a low voter awareness of who these potential school board members are and what they stand for. And maybe it only comes to the parents' attention after they're already in place on the boards, mm-hmm. and you know, these initiatives are you know, finally becoming public. And then, as you say, yeah, the parents in some places, yeah, they're all for it. There are a lot of, you know, really leftist parents in the country.
Oh yeah.
But in other places, as they're finding out for the first time, they want no part of it, and that's when you see these videos that have gone viral all over the place of parents by the dozens and even hundreds packing school board meetings and you know, demanding their voices be heard in objection to this kind of curriculum, and sometimes you know, replacing the school board. I mean, even on the spot, out with the old and
Aurora, Colorado.
Get the bums
yeah.
out, bring
yeah.
in
yeah.
somebody who actually reflects what the parents want their children to be taught in school.
Yeah, this I think is going to be the probably the greatest impact of the 2022 election. It's not so much Congress, because you're still going to get deep state people replacing other deep state people, and, you know, corrupt members of Congress, you know, replacing other corrupt members of Congress. So I don't see a whole lot of change there. But the school boards, I think Steve Bannon mentioned this. I know you've talked about it, and I'm glad we're talking about this now. In fact, I just had a caller who came and dropped. So call back. This is interesting. And normally we don't talk about this stuff, but I think it's really important. In fact, Claire and I didn't plan this discussion at all. I just find it fascinating.
No.
But I think this is really important for us to talk about. Yeah. Claire?
Yeah, I was just going to say, yes, we did not plan this topic. Sometimes topics just spring up, and here we are.
This is how we do action radio. Yeah. I got Bianca in the line now. So, Bianca, just hold on a second. I want to get you in a little bit. But What's happening is the school boards, when they see all these parents, they're declaring meetings unlawful, an unlawful assembly. They're having parents arrested. They're leaving out the back door. They're doing things in secret. They're canceling meetings. They're scheduling during the day when everybody else is working. They're doing everything they can to sort of maintain their power and their Marxism. And I think the best thing the parents can do is literally replace them. If we can replace, you know, a huge amount of school boards with concerned, you know, especially conservative, you know, patriot or even liberal, you know, American loving parents, as opposed to the Marxist hating America crowd, that's going to be huge, because that would end the indoctrination in the schools. If the school boards all change in the states where they can have that kind of effect, that's going to be a massive change for our next generation.
Yeah, it absolutely will be. And that's exactly what needs to happen. And
mm-hmm.
again, what we're looking at is, in America, I mean, I don't know that this is possible in a whole bunch of other places around the world, even in other representative democratic countries. But here, we've got this grassroots activism that we see springing up organically, you know, from among the people. And that's exactly what needs to happen. It is happening, and I expect to see more of it.
Yeah, this is really encouraging. In fact, I want to work with any state that has a situation where there's a state board of education. If you want to decentralize it to a county board level, that's a place where we can write that kind of legislation. We can put it into state law and either abolish these state boards or just have them be, I don't know, we'll change it such that that the county school boards have the majority of the power, because, you know, the more local you make the politics, the greater access that an individual has to be able to change things. And I find this, I'm really excited about what's happening here. In fact, I know some things, I work with some parents around here in the Santa Rosa County School District where I live. And so it's, I don't have a kid in school, she's grown, but it is fascinating to work with parents, because I know what, you know, how going through the process, how it worked. Bianca, you're back and you're on with Claire Lopez, and we're talking education today. Who would have thought? Welcome, sir.
Yeah, you know, one of the things is that you don't have the ability to recall school board members in many states. And that's a necessity, because you don't know really who you're voting for. And you have groups, organizations with agendas that will run and sponsor to candidates and run them as a slate. And many times they get elected. And then you have some slick things going, like I've seen in St. Louis, where they voted, the people voted three school board members in,
Mm-hmm.
And the newly elected mayor, the first female African-American mayor, took one of the school board members and assigned him to a city hall position. And then the next person with the next runner-up in votes, she appointed her to the school board. So there's all sorts of things going on, but ultimately the parents have to know and be concerned. And if you don't have a concerned parent, a concerned citizenry, anything can happen, as we see.
Yeah, once the games start, you know, this is the kind of thing where, you know, once the Marxists get an idea of what's going on, they're going to pour money into the school board elections, and they're going to smear and demonize, and they're going to say that, you know, parent X is a racist, that they have a long track record of whatever, even if that just make up stuff. And so these are going to become very contentious elections. And my fear is that parents aren't going to have enough money to combat, for example, if Facebook and George Soros pour, you know, billions of dollars into re-electing Marxist school board members, we got a real fight on our hands. Claire, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. But you know, take the flip side of that, and that is that the very fact that they would have to contest and pour money in and try to influence these school board members' elections is a new development. That wasn't even happening up until the last year or something. I mean, yes, in various different locales, there were, you know, school board elections that were contentious and got the attention of local parents. But, I mean, this kind of broad, you know, nationwide awareness now focused at the school board level, that just wasn't there before the last number of months. And the fact that it is now, I think is a positive thing. Okay, let the battle be joined. There wasn't even a battle before.
Yeah, and sometimes the greatest things happen by accident, and you got to run with it. One of your lines is a little staticky. I don't know which one it is. I'm guessing Pianki's probably because you just joined us. But we may have you. Let me try mute. Yeah, sorry, he's going to call back. No, it's your line, Claire. We're getting a little static from you.
Well, I can hear it myself. Wait, there it stopped.
Okay, good. There we go. Here, that's good. All right, we're fine. I want to change things. We've only got about 17 minutes left. Hopefully, Pianki, I'm sure he'll call right back in. What's our most important, I guess, foreign policy misadventure from the Biden folks? You know, what's going on in Syria? I'm not really understanding what bases we have, what bases are attacked. You know, what's the logic of what's happening there? Can you kind of give me the story there?
Well, it goes to Iran is where it goes to. Now, folks may know that the United States has troops, personnel stationed in various places, bases around what formerly was the country of Iraq. I can hardly call it a country anymore. It's coming apart at the seams. But a number of Americans at various bases there. And with the weakness so evident in the White House, the Iranian regime, which, by the way, just held presidential selections, and that new president, Ibrahim Raisi, will take office in August, a little more than a month from now. Iran is pushing the envelope to see how much it can get away with. It couldn't get away with much under President Trump, and you know, to the contrary, they were placed under stiff and numerous sanctions. But that's no longer the case. Yes, the sanctions are still on, but they're hoping to get them removed. But part of the pressure campaign to get them removed and to get the talks in Vienna revived, restarted, they're on break right now, with concessions from the United States, part of that campaign of pressure by the Iranian regime, are using its proxy militias. People probably know that the Iranian regime, sponsors all kinds of proxy militias across the Middle East. Everybody knows about Hamas, of course, and Hezbollah, the Houthis in Yemen. Well, in Iraq, there are a whole bunch of smaller proxy militia forces, collectively sometimes called the Hashd al-Shaabi. These rampage across Iraq, attacking both Iraqi bases, military, but also places where American personnel are stationed. And they've done this now, recently. They'll attack them with rockets and missiles and so forth. Well, in the past week or so, Biden administration actually woke up from its nappy time, had a little sip of warm milk, and launched retaliatory strikes against some of these militia bases on both sides of the border, the Iraqi side and the Syrian side, and caused a bit of damage. I don't know if there were any casualties or not. And you know, that was kind of that. I mean, nothing like the resolve of Israel, first and foremost, you know, hit them hard, go after them hard, or of a President Trump, same thing, go after them truly hard. And we'll remember back in January of 2020 when President Trump ordered the takedown of the Quds Force commander, Qasem Soleimani. Mm-hmm. Nothing like that even contemplated inside of this White House, and Iran knows it. So I expect these pressure tactics to keep up. We can only hope that no American personnel become casualties.
So they haven't yet? We haven't lost anybody to these militia attacks? That's
good. In the current round, just as I'm talking about the last few weeks, not that I know of and not yet, but... You know, I mean, it's inevitable.
Stuff
at
happens.
Some point it picks up.
Yeah.
There will be
yeah.
casualties injured or, you know, even killed.
Yeah. Yeah, see, this to me, just leaving troops, you know, in small numbers in various places without a really defined mission, it just seems like they're targets. You know, we can't back them up, and should we? Should they even be there? And how dangerous to us are these militia groups? I'm sure they're dangerous to... you know, the Middle East, you know, but to our foreign interests, to our foreign policy, do these militias that Iran is sponsoring pose a particular threat to the United States? I can't see it.
Well, I mean, you know, what is our policy? We don't have at the moment a coherent policy for that part
of
the world.
So there's the problem.
We don't.
Do you see Iran taking over Iraq because they were at war several years ago? I mean, what, 20, 30 years ago? Would this be an opportunity for them to restart that war and maybe take over Iraq, or do they just not want it? Cause...
In so many ways, it doesn't need to be kinetic. In so many ways, the Iranian regime already dominates the Baghdad regime, infiltrating its security forces, infiltrating its military, infiltrating its intelligence. You know, I mean, it's already completely under the influence, at least, if not control. I won't say control, but influence, certainly broad, widespread influence of the Iranian regime.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like when Dr. Pry talks about, you know, winning without firing a shot, very, very Sun Tzu-ish. You know, they have the power, they have the control. They don't need to fire a shot. So that's quite interesting. Have we learned... anything new about Benghazi in terms of what's going on today? Are they, you know, as I understand it, and I might be wrong about this, but Benghazi was a place where Hillary Clinton was actually running guns through to some of the militias, I guess, or maybe our militias that were trying to overthrow Assad. And is there new information, or is the Biden, you know, what I call insurrection, you know, doing things that they were doing under the Obama administration that might cause another Benghazi? Is there anything like that on the horizon?
Well, today Libya is a failed state in every sense of the word.
Okay.
Back in around 2010, 2011, with the Islamic uprising across North Africa, Libya's then ruler, Muammar Gaddafi, was targeted, as were others like Ben Ali in Tunisia and Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. Gaddafi was targeted, and with the Obama White House and Hillary Clinton State Department, they very much took the side of the Muslim Brotherhood. They wanted the Muslim Brotherhood to take over North Africa. And so, yes, first envoy and then later ambassador Chris Stevens was sent to Tripoli, Libya that is, to support the Muslim Brotherhood uprising, and in particular in Benghazi. opened a mission. It wasn't a consulate. It wasn't an embassy. That was in Tripoli. But a mission of some sort, an outpost, a villa in a residential neighborhood, from which, first, as I said, envoy, Chris Stevens was appointed envoy. I've called him America's first envoy to Al-Qaeda because that's what his job was.
Okay. So he wasn't an ambassador then because he wasn't in an embassy,
right? Well, he became ambassador later, but in 2011, during the fight to overthrow Gaddafi, who was killed in October of that year, he was envoy. He was envoy, but he coordinated the flow of weapons that came out of the Middle East. Qatar was a hub for that, and by ship and some by plane, but mostly by ship, came around and unloaded on the Mediterranean ports of Libya, including Benghazi, the weapons, and those were distributed under Chris Stevens' supervision. To the militias. The Muslim Brotherhood were the political leadership trying to overthrow Gaddafi. Al-Qaeda militias were the fighting force, and they got the weapons. And, yes, Gaddafi was overthrown. He was killed in October of 2011. And then the following year, the place descends into total chaos. Christopher Stevens becomes ambassador. And at this point, the United States gets alarmed. And the weapons are sloshing around because all of Gaddafi's stockpiles have been looted, including air missiles, man pads that can bring down airliners. And the panic compelled the Obama administration to change the lead for Libya from the State Department, which was in charge of the overthrow of Gaddafi, to the CIA, which was now tasked with trying to scoop up, buy up, these missiles sloshing about the open marketplace, and they paid a lot of money to buy up missiles, put them on ships, and send those ships back over to Syria to be distributed among, again, the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda forces, militias that were fighting in that battlefield. And so, yeah, that's the record of Libya, and today it remains a failed state. There have been numerous efforts at stabilizing it, but there remain deep divisions in the country, essentially with jihadis in charge.
Yeah. See, that's the part I hadn't heard. I heard that their weapons from Benghazi ending up with Syrian militias. I guess that would be – I didn't know who those militias were, so that makes sense that they're Muslim Brotherhood militias. So in the same way we – our state – not we, because I don't have anything to do with this. But the State Department, Hillary and Obama, were supporting militias in Libya to overthrow Gaddafi. Then they bought the weapons and sent those same weapons to the same militia, Muslim Brotherhood militia, to overthrow Assad in Syria. Is that how that works?
Yes. The uprising against Bashar al-Assad and his Damascus regime was led in 2010-11 by the Muslim Brotherhood, which people may remember has always been the nemesis of the Damascus regime going back to the time of Bashar al-Assad's father, Hafez al-Assad, when in 82, I think it was, 1982, Hafez al-Assad brutally put down an uprising by the Brotherhood and just surrounded at least one city of Hama, surrounded it with artillery and leveled it. I mean, literally leveled the city.
Wow.
With artillery fire, put down that uprising. But Muslim Brotherhood, yeah.
And that's the same one that ran Egypt for a while after Hosni Mubarak, right?
I'm sorry, again, what?
No, that's the same Muslim Brotherhood that ran Egypt for a while under, I forgot who that was, what his name was.
Morsi,
right? Okay.
Uh-huh. That's
same
right.
Group, right?
It is the Muslim Brotherhood. They have a presence across many, many dozens of countries in the world, including, of course, here in the United States, where they have deeply penetrated the agencies of the United States government and including the National Security Council currently.
So that's that was my next question. You know, when I talked about those three women that I found in this article, Susan Rice, who lied through her teeth, and I knew she was lying at the time because she was blinking too much and, you know, doing all the body language. She's not a really great liar, but she was lying that a video You chuckling. I studied these things anyway. But when she said a video caused the attack on our embassy in Benghazi, nobody who had a brain believed that for a second. But she did it. She kept doing it. Now she's on the National Security Council, I guess, with the Biden insurrection. And so that was questioned now is with the same people that were there during the Muslim Brotherhood militia supplying arms running in Libya and in Syria. She's back. So now what's the current situation? What's the latest intelligence? What are they doing? Are they still supplying the Muslim Brotherhood? Are there still arms being run in there? Are there things, behind the scenes that's not being reported? The Biden insurrection is bringing back from the Obama administration, similar policies. They're the same people.
Well, no gun running that I know of on the scale of what went into Benghazi or into the Syrian battlefields currently. No, but what we do see is an infiltration of either Muslim Brotherhood or Muslim Brotherhood affiliated people inside of the Biden administration, and as I mentioned in particular, mm-hmm. the National Security Council, the Director of Intelligence within the National Security Council, named the individual's name Maher Bitar. Maher Bitar mm-hmm. comes out of the Students for Justice in Palestine on the campus of Georgetown University. Students for Justice in Palestine is a project, an offshoot of the American Muslims for Palestine, which itself is a founding member of the USCMO, United States Council of Muslim Organizations, the U.S. Political umbrella group of the Muslim Brotherhood. So there we have an important position, right between the intelligence community and the White House. That's his job, to be the liaison or the go-between in that exchange. Muslim Brotherhood connections.
Is he an immigrant by chance, or is he born here?
I believe he's a citizen. He's born here, but that, that's neither here nor there.
I think about
affiliated in any case.
Yeah. I think about loyalty. It's like when Obama talks about his days in Indonesia, and I'm thinking to myself, there's a reason that we want natural-born citizens being president. And as someone who's born in Canada and grew up, partially in Australia, I'm an American. I'm a naturalized American. But there's still a part of me that feels like a guest here. And so I'm thinking from a psychological point of view, you can't be born in another country and be absolute American. When I look at a Donald Trump, I see an absolute American. I mean, he's as American as it gets. All right. But then I think about, and I'm doing something to try and, boost freedom in this country beyond anything that citizens have ever contemplated. That's the whole purpose of Action Radio. But even so, still in the back of my mind and, in the deep recesses, I still feel like, having been born in Canada, even though I'm a naturalized American, there's still a certain amount of, I'm not, a whole 100% American. And it can't be just because I've experienced it in other places. And this is why I ask you, people are immigrants.
I would beg to differ just a bit, and that is that some of the truest, most patriotic Americans I've ever met are immigrants mm-hmm. who have fled, not nice places like Australia or Canada, but communist regimes
mm-hmm.
Out of Cuba, out of Russia, out of China. Those are the truest, most appreciative American patriots I've ever met.
Yeah. No, and I find that too, having spent, I wasn't a victim of communism, but I certainly spent a day in East Berlin way into it. So I see what it looks like. It's a contradiction because I find myself fighting for this country a lot harder than natural born Americans in general. But on the same token, I also understand a bit of the psychology of this. And I wonder, I should talk to Josie about this, who grew up in communist Nicaragua. You can love this country. You can be a part of it. You can be maybe 100% Americans, maybe not a good characterization. I really hadn't thought this through when I brought up the topic. But there is a difference. And this is why I don't think Obama could ever be completely loyal to this country, simply because of his other experiences, other places, other cultures, other all kinds of stuff, that even though he was president, I don't think he had any loyalty. He couldn't have the loyalty that a Donald Trump can have.
I will say this. I think that there are plenty of immigrants in this country from places they fled from, communist countries, that are true, full-blooded American patriot citizens mm-hmm. than a bunch of Americans born right here on American soil
yeah.
Who've grown up under the influence of ideologies and beliefs and inclinations that are not American.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to have to think about this a bit more. It's just an interesting, I just know about my own experience. It is, I don't know, I need to talk to some more immigrants, but I think you're right in terms of fighting for this country. I'll fight for this country, you know, to my dying day, my last breath. That's the whole purpose of Action Radio. I've made that commitment. But again, it's just, people are complex. And I think it's worth exploring. Anyway, we have to go. We're out of time. Thank you so much. This has been a very unexpected and very wonderful chat this morning. So thank you, Claire. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Greg.
We'll do it again next week. There we go. Greg Fangless for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. The best thing you can do to help what we do here is share the show. The more you share the show, the greater our voice becomes, and the more that we can help you with legislation, with freedom, with information, with all the things that we do here. Okay, if you want to support us, patreon.com/actionradio. Back tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock with our reading, our second reading, second annual reading of the Declaration of Independence.